Welcome to the I Wonder Doctor podcast with David Rosensweet, MD. I Wonder Doctor integrates traditional and complementary medicine with the goal of helping you to get well, to get healthy. It is designed to be done in real life, in real time, by real people, and seeks to inspire as many aha moments as possible.
Let's continue with the digestive process as the food moves out of the stomach into the small intestine.
So we're moving down here. We started with the mouth, for obvious reasons. Then we dropped down to the stomach. We dealt with the stomach stuff. And now we're headed to the nether regions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'd like to illustrate this for you. I'm going to begin where the esophagus joins the stomach. You all remember this. Remember that valve at the top of the stomach there, the lower esophageal sphincter, which keeps food from regurgitating up into the esophagus?
Stops heartburn.
That's right. Well, there's a second valve at the lower end of the stomach that keeps food in the stomach called the pyloric sphincter, also very important. And you'll remember, of course, that the food is now in the stomach. It's being worked upon by the stomach acids that are there. And once this process has had a chance to work, that pyloric sphincter opens up, and that bolus of food moves into the upper small intestine. And that's a very important moment.
Yeah.
Right at the entry of that small intestine, there's a big gland called the pancreas that produces several things. And one of them is sodium bicarbonate, because the acid that's coming out of the stomach must be neutralized. As the next phase, when the pancreas puts out these strong enzymes to digest the food further, they have to work in an alkaline environment.
Got it. So we needed those acids in the stomach to begin the digestive process, but they're not good now.
That's right. They get neutralized.
Yeah.
And then there's another thing that's operative there. There's a bile duct that is the emptying pathway from the gallbladder, and when that bolus of food hits, bile is emptied onto that bolus of food. That's for the emulsification of fats, which has to happen in preparation for the pancreatic enzymes that digest fats.
Yeah.
And that pancreas is putting out some powerful enzymes. It's producing amylases to deal with the carbohydrates. It's, again, got the lipases to deal with the emulsified fats. And it's got these powerful proteases, which continue the process of digestion of protein down into tiny, tiny amino acids as things travel down the rest of the 20 feet for the food to be fully digested and absorbed.
Got it.
Now, do we have to do anything about this phase? Probably. You know, for anyone who wants robust energy for decades and decades, or has healing to do, as most of us do,
yeah.
It turns out that the same processes that diminish our hormones, diminish our neurotransmitters, diminish our hydrochloric acid, also tax and diminish the pancreatic enzyme process. So most adults would benefit by supplementing pancreatic enzymes. And we're going to get highly specific about this. It's not a complicated process, and it's very easy to implement once you get used to it.
Hmm.
And for those who have had their gallbladder removed, you also have to supplement bile.
Yeah,
we'll explain that as well.
Before we started filming this one, an issue came up, and I thought this was really important. We're here, and they're there. Our audience, they're on the front line of these issues, and they're facing these things straight on and probably have questions for us, questions for you, that are of universal benefit, or at least 10,000 other people have the same question. And so we just wanted to put it out there that if you've got these questions that you think other people would benefit from hearing the answers to, please share them with us. We'd really like to address these things.
Absolutely. We'd love to answer your individual issues if we possibly can. I'd like to ask you, how do you know if your digestion is good?
I guess I wouldn't know the answer to that question other than maybe, I don't know, diarrhea or constipation.
Well, those aren't the first things I think of. The most common things are you feel bloated after a meal, or you feel full an hour or two later. You've eaten dinner and you go to lie down to go to sleep several hours later, and you go, oh my God, there's food in my stomach. Or if you're burping early on after eating, or a couple hours later. I mean, what's happening there? Where's that coming from? Well, often it's bacteria in your stomach early, fermenting your food instead of you digesting it.
Bacteria that shouldn't be in the stomach.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or a little later, that it's taking place in the small bowel, the upper part, again, bacteria fermenting your food.
Yeah.
And yeah, the quality of your stool can relate to digestion. As a physician, when someone's got diarrhea, especially if it's painful or constipation, I first think of other things.
Right.
But it can relate to digestion. In fact, toilet science is a great thing to become familiar with.
Oh, good.
For example, if you're not digesting your protein and your minerals, you can form very gluey, tight, hard stools. And with the minerals in them, they can sink to the bottom of that toilet.
Yeah.
Or if you're not digesting hardly anything at all, those stools can be very loose, even diarrhea-like.
Yeah.
And if the stools float, you're not digesting your fats because fats are lighter than water.
Yeah.
The ideal poop is like a submarine. It hovers beneath the surface of the toilet.
So I guess the takeaway from this is we need to learn how to diagnose our own digestion, and there's some obvious signs of it, like burping, maybe excessive farting, a feeling of being full way after a meal, and then, of course, there's the good poop science.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is not hard to address. These aren't illnesses.
Yeah.
These are the common things that happen to adults in their 40s, 50s, 60s. Diminished digestion.
Yeah.
And so you can augment digestion by chewing and supplementing the digestive juices.
And knowing what's not working will help guide me in the correct healing process.
Exactly.
Got it.
I'd like to look at how digestion can go wrong, beginning with the food itself.
I guess what I really feel is I'm a little tired of the amount of education that everything in life seems to require. I really sort of want to be told what to do so that I can get better.
Thus you think. But, you know, for patients who have got actual diagnoses,
yeah,
and their interest and commitment is elevated, and I find over many years of practicing medicine, telling them why something happens can really help inspire them to do what they need to do. For example, if I say, chew your food more. Yeah, my mom told me that. But if I explain how it breaks down to the tiny particles and that works better in the stomach, they get it and they're willing to do it.
Yeah.
So I say, bear with me.
Okay.
And on this subject, digestion can begin with the food itself. You remember when the apple falls from the tree and it doesn't rot, it's really a matter of digestion because the food itself has digestive enzymes in it.
Yeah.
Well, the food that has the very best digestive enzymes is very fresh food. So, for example, if you had a garden and you picked it and made a salad out of it, that's going to have the best and highest quality and highest quantity of active digestive enzymes. Whereas if a food has come from Chile or from the West Coast or the East Coast of the United States and you're far away from that,
yeah,
that's different food. That's had time to denature those enzymes. So fresh really matters.
So enzymes over time sort of lose their potency.
They do, as do nutrients in the food, actually.
Yeah.
And then food can be altered, certainly by processing. Processed food, just if it comes in a bottle, box, can, or bag, it doesn't have active enzymes in it. It's too much manufacturing has gone into that.
Yeah.
And a perfect example of that actually is in the world of dairy. For example, when you pasteurize something, you alter those protein molecules. So let me tell you about Drs. Price and Pottinger. And this was based on research done in the early 1900s. They were researching dentistry and what happens in cats and what happens to their jawbone and their teeth and their orthodontic structure.
Yeah.
And they were feeding them raw milk. And they had indoor-outdoor cages where these cats could roam freely, and their outdoor part of their cage was just lush.
They were feeding them raw milk because that's what was available at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then that changed, and pasteurized milk became the most prevalent one, and they just made the change, and they started noticing that the cat's dental structure was deteriorating, as was their ability to maintain a pregnancy, as was the quality of the vegetation in their outdoor part.
Because there weren't as many nutrients being fed to those weeds and such.
Exactly, and the cat's poop.
Yeah.
And they switched their research over to tell the difference between raw dairy and pasteurized dairy. And there's a Price-Pottinger Institute that's alive and well today. This is how significant it is.
This one's challenging because you're talking about raw dairy, and I think one thing is that people are afraid of it, and another thing is that it's illegal, right? At least in some places.
Well, in a lot of places it's not illegal. You can obtain raw dairy. In California, for example, is a perfect example of this.
Yeah.
And listen, bottom line, you pasteurize dairy, you subject it to high heat and pressure, and that can alter the protein molecule. And there's some people who have major challenges with dairy. And then other processing methods can really give food a lot of trouble. Like you take a grain like rice,
yeah,
and you remove the hull, or you crack it open like they do to oats. You expose the fats inside of there to oxidation. That's called rancidity. You alter those molecules, and you make them much harder to digest. And there's a whole subject that we're going to get into called your immune system reacting to these altered food products. And that's called food allergy, and that can be very prevalent in autoimmune diseases. So this is not a small deal,
yeah,
that I'm talking about here. So what can you do about it? You can grow your own. That's the very best. Or find your local farmer's market, or especially organic in your or in your supermarkets or your health food stores. And reduce, again, the bottles, boxes, and cans, because that really matters. And then boil or steam your food. That's about the much cooking that doesn't damage the food. But if you get into barbecuing, broiling, baking, you're heating it up so high that you're going to be altering the molecular structure of the proteins in that food. So welcome to the world of when you really want to get better, there's a lot you need to do.
So how do you make the transition? I mean, there's so many things you've talked about at once here.
Yeah, well, we're going to take on every one of these issues in I Wonder Doctor. Right now, raise the possibility that you could make that transition. And then here's the most important thing about it. We don't want you to stress in the process. These people who leap to pure diets, but they're highly stressed in the process, the stress itself is so much more detrimental to them than the actual purity of the food they're eating.
Yeah.
So you may have encountered some people who have be called health food nuts, and they're a little intense and rough to deal with.
Yeah.
No, we don't want you to go there. And I Wonder Doctor, you're going to hear us this drumbeat from us over and over again. Take on what's the highest priority, one project at a time, and especially in a way that you don't stress yourself. If you're on the actual road in a commitment to heal, you want to design that process very carefully so you are not triggering the biological stress and the hormones and neurotransmitters and all the trouble you get into when you are stressed by your healing process. So we're going to help guide you in that one very carefully, because you can take it on slowly. This isn't, you have to make all these changes today. Give yourself years. I like the 7-year plans.
Great.
Let's talk about organic.
I guess when I think of organic is ching. I mean, like I go into my local grocery store and there are two avocados as an example next to each other. One of them's organic, one of them's not. They look about the same. The organic one is $50 billion or some such, and the non-organic one is 5 cents. I mean, it's a lot of money, a big difference.
Well, I love your math. The organic one is 100 billion times more expensive. Not really. But let me address that later. I want to talk about organic in general.
Yeah.
Our species, Homo sapiens, appeared on the Earth about 200,000 years ago. And from that moment until the 1940s, there was no word called organic. It was called food. It was the only food that there was.
Yeah.
In the 1930s, the United States Senate started commenting on the decline of mineral content in American soils, significant enough to write a report on it.
Yeah.
Yet the real problem occurred in the 1940s. After World War II, there was all these ammunition nitrates available, and someone had the idea, well, that contains nitrogen, let's dump it on the American soil, and they did.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, the crops grew much faster and taller.
Yeah.
And yet, the nitrogen made them grow faster and taller, but they didn't put the other nutrients in there. They didn't put the minerals in there, for example, or the vitamins. So these foods that grew more robustly were mineral and nutrient deficient and unhealthy and more vulnerable to attack by insects. Mm. And so that had to be followed up by the insecticides and the herbicides as well. And what does it take chemically to kill an insect? A lot. These are very hardy creatures. And one of the most common problems we face in the multitude of causes of people's diagnoses and illnesses these days are the toxicities involved. And this is a major stream of toxin coming in through the American food supply.
Your timing is pretty interesting on this. I mean, you talk about this hitting the market in the 40s.
Yeah.
Well, that means that the majority, if not almost practically everybody alive today, almost all they've ever eaten is these agribusiness things, and yet we're living the longest lives we've ever lived. I mean, we're outstripping the lives of those 1500s and 1600s people by a mile.
And it has nothing to do with the nutrition. The nutrition is deteriorated. There is no question about that.
Yeah.
But other things, like the antibiotics preventing epidemics and people not having to slave physically so hard that they're wearing themselves out at younger ages. No, this is an entirely different reason, and it's not because of the nutrition.
We're living longer because of advances in medicine.
You betcha.
You know,
childbirth.
Yeah.
Infectious diseases, absolutely.
Yeah.
And yet, the nutritional illnesses, diabetes, heart disease, big origin in nutritional problems. That's what the new epidemic diseases are.
So these things are on the rise.
You betcha they are.
Yeah.
And people who didn't grow up when I grew up, they don't know what a chicken tastes like. They don't know what a tomato tastes like. I mean, I remember it very clearly. And sometimes my grandparents would take me out to the farms because you could pick them yourselves. And, oh, my goodness, the taste of fresh chicken and fresh corn and fresh tomatoes, they're outrageously different. Why? Because the vitamin and mineral content, which the taste depends on so much, was so rich back then. Yet, let me break it down to another nutritional issue that occurs. Your being, your brain, although you may not be conscious of it, you sit down to an agribusiness meal,
yeah,
and it's deficient in the nutrients, and you eat and eat and you're full, but your brain is going, where's my magnesium, where's my zinc? Well, we got to eat some more food. And so people are partially overeating because they're trying to graze through to get the nutrients that they're missing from the food. Anyone on a weight loss plan, oh my goodness, become a friend of organic, because you're going to be satisfied much earlier because you're getting the nutrients that your body actually wants.
So eating organic can help someone lose weight?
Big time. It's one of the cornerstones of a multifaceted weight loss program. And we talked about the price, right? You started this off with the $100 billion difference. I'd like to reiterate something I said in an earlier video that, you know, you pay now.
Yeah.
Or you're going to pay big time later, because a little additional food cost now. What about the medical costs, the loss of work because you don't feel good, the deterioration of your social life because you've lost energy? The medical costs, these are astronomical. Your insurance is not going to pay for everything. Now, it's hard for a young person often to have that long-range view. But, you know, some young people actually get it that it's probably a good idea to put away retirement money. Well, you want to save big money and live well into your 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I can tell you, in dealing with older people who don't feel well, ooh, they do not like it. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Invest in that. You're going to love it. You're going to be playing. You're going to be walking and talking and maybe even doing some athletic things and being able to take care of your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren and actually play with them and actually think clearly enough to talk to them. Oh, my goodness. Nutrition is a big reason that you're going to celebrate it if you have the foresight to invest now.
Got it.
A very big thanks to all the people it takes to produce these. And thanks to you for listening. Be sure to head on over to iwonderdoctor.com for all the rest that we have to offer.